Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. This week saw seven Marines and one Navy corpsman charged with murder and kidnapping in Iraq. The week also featured a failed effort by Senate Democrats to set a date certain on the withdrawal of U.S. troops. The facts on the ground and the politics of war and peace at home are among the issues our weekly panel of journalists will consider this hour. Also up for discussion, the FBI breaks up an alleged homegrown terror plot in Miami, the case in favor of repealing the Voting Rights Act, the failed effort to raise the minimum wage, and Democrat Joe Lieberman's hawkish support of the war lands him in a tough fight to retain his Senate seat. Up next on Point, our weekly roundtable considers another week of war, Congress, politics, and your calls. And we have a great group of smart analysts with us this hour to size up the big stories of the week. First, I'm happy to introduce John McWhorter. He joins us from New York. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a frequent op-ed contributor for the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times. He's also author of Winning the Race, Beyond the Crisis in Black America. And John McWhorter, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us from Hartford, Connecticut is Bill Curry, columnist for the Hartford Current. Bill Curry was a senior domestic policy advisor to President Clinton and twice the Democratic nominee for governor in Connecticut. Bill Curry, good day to you. Welcome.
Great to be here, Anthony. Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire is our own On Point News analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Great to have you with us as always, Jack.
Hello, Anthony, John, and Bill.
Bill, let me start with you, Bill Curry, in Connecticut. Your big story of the week. I want to go quickly around this virtual roundtable that we have here and find out what you've all been thinking about, what's been occupying your thought. What's on top of your list, Bill?
Well, I think that the Kerry proposal in the Senate and this debate within the Democratic Party and between the Democrats and Republicans over what to do with Iraq. And I think Kerry, again, looks in this election year as he upcoming as he did in the last one, as if, you know, then he was pitching right-wing voters by supporting the war, and now he's pitching left-wing voters by calling for a deadline. I think it shows the weakness of the Democrats needing a plan to show how we actually deal with this situation, not just when, but how do you get out? Mm. Of course, at the same time, I think that the majority of Democrats, not including Kerry, but a majority of Democrats in the beginning had the right plan in Iraq, which was not to go in.
We're talking specifically about the proposal from John Kerry and Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. They wanted to force President Bush to withdraw virtually all troops from Iraq by July of 2007. That was defeated resoundingly, 86-13. Bill, how will this play out in the fall? Because obviously these are politicians being politicians. They're looking at polls. They know that the war isn't popular with Americans. How will this play out in November?
Well, there's a lot of risk here on both sides. First of all, the Republicans want to convince the country that blind adherence to the status quo fulfills the definition of a plan, and you know, that's theirs. And that the Democrats and along with them anybody who's noticed over the last 3 years that the administration's policy is inept and misguided is somehow traitorous, and that's the subtext here. The subtext of every single speech, every single presentation on right-wing talk radio is that anybody who's noticed this doesn't work wants to cut and run, which is a trope for mm-hmm. someone who'd leave a comrade on a battlefield. And so they're going to go back to that kind of – in part, along with immigration and a set of other issues, this is about setting us up for another culture war for the November elections, which they fear they're otherwise losing.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back to this subject, obviously, as the hour goes forward. But let me move around the table here. John McWhorter, what's on your mind this week? What have you been following?
Well, in addition to that very point on the war, what has really struck me is this issue about the Voting Rights Act and the fact that we are looking at renewing it, which I think is a wonderful thing. It's not that I think the Voting Rights Act should be repealed. But then there's this amendment that some Republicans are proposing, which will take the special attention away from certain southern states, which has been the case for the past 41 years because back in the day, of course, it was in these southern states that black people were not allowed to vote because black people were thought of as animals. However, now, 41 years later, it's being proposed by some Republicans from these states that this stop because they think that this special attention to all of their voting processes no longer corresponds to modern reality. And, of course, there are those who are saying that that is a racist notion, that there is still some effort to prevent the black vote in these states, that you can't mess with the Voting Rights Act at all because that would put us back to where we were in the grievous past. I disagree. I think that it's actually time to admit that in those ways the South has changed. That's not to say that there's no such thing as any kind of residual racism in the South or in America, but these Republicans on this particular point are correct.
Interesting. So we're talking specifically this week, Republican leaders canceled a plan for, or put off, I guess, a planned vote to renew the Voting Rights Act on Wednesday.
That's right.
And we should point out that the law doesn't expire till next year, so there's still time to come back to it, and they plan to come back to it.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. Good. Interesting points. We'll come back to that as well. Finally, last but not least, Jack Beatty, what have you been following?
Well, I've been following the collapse of accountability in the Congress, vis-a-vis the Congress and the administration and within the Congress. Senator Byron Dorgan introduced a bill to form a Truman Committee, that is to say a select committee of the Senate, to investigate war profiteering. And that was turned down. You know, in history, you compare like to like. During the Civil War, Republicans ruled. They had a select committee on the conduct of the war that raised hell with the Lincoln administration. Lincoln had to fire his Secretary of War, cashier, the Assistant Secretary, move generals around, all because of the ruckus about contracting and other things. This Republican committee laid at his feet. In the Second World War, Democrats ruled. Harry Truman had a committee, again, dominated by Democrats, looking into malfeasance and corruption in war contract. They saved $15 billion. This is the first war where, in effect, we are not going to look at and hold accountable the contracting practices that we all know are flagrant. And, in fact, Senator Dorgan gave a list of these things. I mean, just at the top, off the top of my head, he talked about the Halliburton subsidiary out there. Ordering towels for millions of towels for the troops, but doubling the cost on them because they wanted the Brown and Root logo on each on each towel. He talked about a doctor calling him from a hospital someplace saying the water we are being given is not potable. The water from the Tigris is better. This is coming from contractors. He talked about a contractor calling him and saying, look, I was told by the people at Brown and Root, if I talk to the inspector general, I'm going to get cashiered or sent to Fallujah. In fact, he did talk to the inspector general. He was sent to Fallujah. Mm-hmm. There's going to be no accountability of this on this from the U.S. Senate.
Wow. So Senator Byron Dorgan's proposed legislation was voted down 44 to 42, not surprisingly, right along party lines. Isn't this just more of the same? I mean, it's not new that this Congress is very much divided along party lines on a lot of issues, right?
No, that's true. But, you know, there used to be something, as I say, yeah, of inter-branch checks and balances. We now have something like party government in the United States. We do not have a functioning check and balance system. And we even have it within the Congress. This week, you know, the whole Abramoff scandal, what's been the upshot of that? A committee that now the Ethics Committee is going to have to sign off on each travel junket that the congressmen take. Well, of course, the Ethics Committee is full of some of the biggest travelers in Congress. This is not accountability. They won't even keep their own house in order.
Okay.
You know, yeah, divided government has been an American sort of folk wisdom for a long time. We've just had a 6-year experiment with united government. People have to ask themselves, is it really working?
Okay, well, there you have it. There are three big issues to get us going this hour: accountability, the vote on the Voting Rights Act, and the Democratic vote on pullout of U.S. troops from Iraq. Let's go back to that first story. The Republican-controlled Senate rejected two Democratic measures calling for withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq. Here's what Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, one of the sponsors of one of the proposals, had to say.
I believe we need a hard and fast deadline, not an open-ended commitment of U.S. forces.
And yesterday, Vice President Dick Cheney told CNN the Democrats' plan to get out of Iraq is a bad idea.
What happens in the global war on terror if the United States bails out in Iraq? And that's exactly what withdrawal is. So you're going to take your troops out before the conflict is over with. You're not going to complete the mission if we follow the Democrats' advice.
Okay, gentlemen. Well, I'd love all three of you to chime in on this. Let me invite you, John McWhorter. What's your take on how this debate played out in Congress with the Democrats urging the president to set a date certain on the Iraqi pullout?
It's hideously disappointing because, really, I will openly say that I was completely in favor of the war in Iraq. The whole neocon argument about providing a democratic example of an Islamic country, etc., I was with it. Unfortunately, it wasn't done right, and we've dragged along. And it seems to me that the benchmark issue is how do you feel about sending your child into it, or how would you feel about going yourself? In the beginning, I thought I would gladly lose a leg to do this if I were drafted somehow. I would send a child to do it. We can accomplish nothing at this point, and we need to just let the Iraqis sort it out for themselves. That's not pretty, but that's where we've brought ourselves, and there's no point in trying any further.
Well, Bill Curry, you know, it's surprising to hear that from John McWhorter. Not surprising, but to me what's striking is this is the one thing the Democrats aren't saying. They're saying pull out, pull out, pull out, but they're not talking about consequences, and that is the consequences are not pretty. And they're not saying if we stay, the consequences aren't pretty. If we pull out, the consequences aren't pretty, but let's get out of there and let it sink without us.
For everyone who opposed this war from the beginning, and the only issue I would take with John is that this wasn't simply a matter of poor execution. It's kind of the default position of a lot of the neoconservatives and Tom Friedman and others that, you know, it was a great idea when we had it. These guys just screwed up the execution. This was a fundamental and I think a disastrous mistake on every level from the beginning. But now you're in it, and that's why, you know, that's why they call it a quagmire, because there's no easy way out. And I actually, as bitter as I was from the beginning about this mistake, which I think has weakened us, you look at what's happening with Iran, North Korea, look at our relations with the world across the board. This we've paid a huge price in this, beyond the price even in lives and money. Hmm. But the fact of the matter is, we now have to move in a responsible way. It's again, it's not just when to get out, but how to get out. And no matter what side of this you're on, I think you do owe an explanation to the American people and to the world that explains how it is that we leave without inviting in the chaos. The idea was that we would go into Iraq and export democracy to the rest of the region. This was a culturally and politically obtuse idea from the get-go. But now we may be importing into Iraq even worse chaos than came with the war itself, and even more bloodshed. And you got to show it. In my own view, you have to show a way out. I want the leadership that can get us out of there most quickly. And that begins with a lot of other just changes. And just we should have been in Cairo. We should get the parties back to Cairo. When they said they wanted a timetable, then we should meet with the Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds, who had to tell their own Iraqi constituencies that they needed to find a road out and quickly, and at least begin to set goals with them and to do that in a public way. We need to renounce military bases and oil. We need to demonstrate a commitment to multilateralism. There are so many things the United States needs to do differently in the foreign policy that has brought us to the point where we're mired in Iraq and at odds with the world. The Democrats don't just have to say get out. They have to say how.
Yeah. Go ahead, John McWhorter.
And if there's one glimmer of hope, all of that is true, it's that a lot of what stokes what's going on in Iraq right now is resentment at the fact that we are there. To the extent that we are no longer physically there, that will take away the excuse that some people have for not dealing with the internal problems. It won't be paradise, but we only make it worse at this point by being there as the invading evil American power. We have to take away that crutch. That's maybe one benefit from leaving.
Yeah, Jack Beattie, I hear you.
And of all people, the Iraqi National Security Advisor made just that point in the Washington Post this week. He said that removing the foreign troops would help the country because it would remove what many Iraqis, probably all of them, see as an illegitimate occupation and a delegitimizing connection with the current regime.
Exactly.
So there you have the Iraqi National Security Advisor saying that, you know, here's the choice. The GOP sees no light at the end of the tunnel. They have an open-ended policy. And if you look at the facts on the ground in Iraq, they are not this situation is not getting better. There is only one battalion now that can function on its own. Only one. We are not turning over to the Iraqis air force, planes. Nope. And we have found again and again in this war, that's been the decisive thing. That's what got Zarqawi bombing. We're not giving it to them. Why? Because we're afraid that that's going to fall into somebody, you know, there'll be a revolution. It'll fall into the wrong hands. We're not setting them up to take our place. In fact, we're digging in deeper. The Democrats say, time, we're going to get out. We have to get out. The parties now have a clear difference.
Hmm. Alan is calling from Hermitage, Tennessee. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I don't know what we win if we stay there and win in the Bush view of things. You know, stay the course until we win. What have we won other than the responsibility to keep repairing that country and trying to get it back to where it was before we went in? You know, it's embarrassing to see generals have to get on TV and say, well, we're doing something right. We opened a school today. That's certainly nice, but is that what it's all about, that kind of thing? Why fight a war to build a school?
So what do we do? I mean, do you agree, Alan, with the Democrats' effort to set a date certain to get out? Is that the approach to sort of say, we lost, we got to go home, cut our losses?
I don't know that you have to say we lost. We can just say, well, you now have a government. We're glad you have a government. Good luck, and let us know if you need some foreign aid now and then or something, and then start leaving.
Yeah, John McWhorter.
He's right, and on that, really, we have to understand that part of allowing Iraq to run itself involves leaving. You don't really learn to speak a foreign language until you spend a year in the country and nobody wants to speak English with you. A bird has to be pushed out of the nest. It's an unfortunate analogy. But in this case, we can't expect them to learn to do the things that we would like them to do and that any country would like itself to do if we're always there to take up the slack. I think that they'll learn. It might take some years and a lot of people will die, but they will run themselves to a large extent when there's no one else to do it for them. I think we sell them short to assume that they'll just be butchering each other for the next 50 years.
John, you know,
Bill Curry.
With all respect, just that phrase, you know, it may take a few years and some people may die.
We tossed off
ideas like that too casually when we walked into this. And again, speaking as someone who's opposed this from the beginning and who agrees with much that you said, I think both sides, the right by and large pretends that they know that if we leave immediately, it will be plunged into chaos and further bloodshed. And the left pretends that we don't have to consider that. And in between those two positions, there has to be a responsible foreign policy, I think, that recognizes in one of the few intelligent phrases that have passed the lips of Donald Rumsfeld, that we have to have respect for what we don't know. And we don't have the right at this point to simply casually plunge them into that. It's smart people in Iraq want us out of there in as early as possible. They don't want to wake up tomorrow morning and find we left at 11 o'clock that night.
Yeah.
No. And none of us knows what happens.
But in fairness, nobody's talking about – I mean, no one is proposing that.
It's an exaggeration. But in terms of the deadline, and again, there are just so many things we can be doing. We ought to be renouncing any preferential treatment on oil. We ought to be renouncing military bases in the future. We said we didn't go in for those things. We ought to be standing up for it.
But the question is
last word on Iraq to you, John McWhorter, because then we've got to move on to some other issues.
Okay. Very quickly, I was just going to say, is there anything we can do at this unfortunate point that would not involve many people dying? It seems to me, just from the logical standpoint, that we can't avoid it. But I'm not trying to sound like I don't understand the hideousness of that.
Okay, well, let's leave Iraq there.
We're not far apart.
Yeah, let's leave Iraq there for now and move on to some other issues. Minimum wage. For the past 9 years, the minimum wage has been stuck at $5.15 an hour, $5.15 an hour, and it looks like it will stay there for the foreseeable future. Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat from Massachusetts, reminded his fellow senators that they haven't waited that long for their own raises.
9 years they've waited. 9 years they've waited, but not the members of the United States Senate. $30,000 we've increased our salary, and 9 years we've refused to provide an increase. The men and women that are working on the lowest rung of the economic ladder. That is obscene, Mr. President.
That's Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts in full voice on the floor of the Senate, speaking in favor of a raise in the minimum wage. Senator Michael Enzi, Republican from Wyoming, offered an alternative that would have raised the federal wage floor by $1.10 with some incentives for business. Enzi said workers need to take more responsibility for their own financial futures.
People need to think a little bit about more training or moving a little bit to get better jobs and get out of the minimum wage rut that will cause a spiral. As we increase the minimum wage, we also cause an upward spiral that eliminates the value of that minimum wage.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of this debate on the Senate floor about the minimum wage and the fact that it's been stuck there for many years?
Again, this is a clear party difference. The Republican Party will not raise the minimum wage. In the House, they would not even bring it to a vote for fear that it might pass. That is to say, Republican lawmakers in sensitive districts might well vote for it. You know, polls show by 80%, something like that, Americans favor a higher minimum wage. They don't like the idea that a single woman with two kids who works full-time for the minimum wage still gets about $2,700 less than the poverty line. People don't like that. They want the work ethic to be vindicated and not to be undermined. And, you know, at the same time, these people, the Republicans, are doing this on the minimum wage. What are they doing on the estate tax? They are coming back with the estate tax in the House. This Paris Hilton tax, effectively, this is about 2,500 people a year. That's the difference. That's what the Republicans, that they want those 2,500 people a year who would leave more than $3.5 million not to be taxed, and or to be taxed only at the top, only at the heirs of Bill Gates, effectively removing the estate tax. You know, this is such an obscene situation. Paris Hilton versus the minimum wage. 15% of our earners versus 2,500 rich people who didn't even earn it. They're just getting their parents' money. I mean, it is just the argument that we are ruled by an oligarchy has never had a more irrefutable piece of evidence than the juxtaposition.
Before we respond to Jack, I just want to put in some facts here about what happened, because we switched gears from minimum wage to estate tax. And this week, the House passed an estate tax cut that goes pretty far. They didn't kill it, but they would, the plan would exempt individual estates up to $5 million from taxes, from an inheritance tax, and couples estates up to $10 million. And according to one analysis by the New York Times, 5,000 estates would face taxation. That's compared to 30,000 estates that were taxed in 2004. So I just want to put that out. That's where the estate tax debate stands right now. What do you make of it, John McWhorter?
Oh, I certainly agree with Jack about the estate tax or death tax. But on the minimum wage, it just has to always be brought into the discussion that there is a great deal of evidence that if you raise the minimum wage too much, then you end up cutting jobs. Nevertheless, when as much time as this has gone by, clearly something needs to be done. And I think it ought to be kind of a social policy, because we do have a concern these days with what we're calling the working poor. As a black person, I have a particular concern with people who are making do after welfare reform in 1996. At this point, we're now looking at the men who were part of that, what you might call dependency culture from the late 60s until 1996. And these are people who, with low skills, need to be able to make a decent living, and they shouldn't be existing $3,000 below the poverty line. So it would be nice if certainly the minimum wage were raised to a certain point, but it has to always be made clear that if you raise it too much, then you end up denying the very people who need them jobs. And so we just have to hope that poverty is something that people cycle through, which is something that tends to be not acknowledged enough. There's a large extent to which somebody who's poor right now will not be when you take a look at the census in the next 10 years. It depends on how you feel about the evil of capitalism, the better of many evils.
I want to bring Dan into the conversation, who's calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan.
Hi. A couple of things. I think the Democrats need a shift in their plan. Rather than spending all the time talking about the war, what they need to basically say, it's a corrupt war. Don't call the Republicans who are involved in this neoconservatives. Call them war profiteers. And the emphasis should be on families. Are you well off now or worse off with the price of gas, price of health care, the inability to have a rise in wages, mm-hmm. unemployment, et cetera. I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, it's a good suggestion. Bill Curry, does that sound like a good strategy to you for the Democrats to take the focus off the war and focus on pocketbook issues at home?
I think that the senior senator from Massachusetts was involved in a floor debate this week that was much more on point for Democrats hoping to take control of the Congress and, more importantly, lead this nation than the junior senator was. And also because both of those Iraqi measures, again, were really sort of each one was, in a sense, a sense of the Senate resolution, whereas the Kennedy a proposal was just get the minimum wage up over $7. I have to disagree with John again. I don't think that there is evidence about the effect of the minimum wage on jobs. And in fact, it's mostly theory. It's people who settled for ideology over empiricism, who don't look at the facts first. Every one of these conservative papers I've read in the subject over the years I've been doing this tell you why it ought to have that effect, but they never show that it did. And all the empirical stuff, every time you look at the economy after they raise the minimum wage, things get better. Things get better. So we should just put that aside. The fact of the matter is this is becoming ever more income unequal as a nation. We used to compare ourselves to Europe and be happy about our egalitarianism. A part of the American dream was that we spread the wealth through a free market. But what we need to learn as a country, liberals have had to learn in the last 20 years, that markets create wealth. It's time for conservatives to learn that they don't distribute the wealth, that the tendency, in fact, of markets like these, especially in times of change, is to concentrate wealth. And if you don't have a minimum wage, if you don't have stronger unions, if you don't have a role for government with a GI Bill and a social contract, you're going to get what we're getting right now. And it is the emergence of the new American oligarchy. And we've all got to stand up, regardless of our partisan or ideological standing, and find a way out of this.
I just want to say that the evidence on the minimum wage is not quite that unequivocal. I've read three studies that show that there is an effect. It's a minor effect. It's not catastrophic. But the minimum wage being raised can decrease the amount of jobs that are available.
The effect of a $5 minimum wage in the lives of people who are out there working for that kind of money is catastrophic.
Gentlemen, a new subject. I mentioned Vienna. President Bush was in Europe this week. In Vienna, he was welcomed by the Vienna Boys Choir, but there was also a chorus of protesters to welcome him as well. The president responded to questions from the foreign press about America's image in Europe and the world.
And I'll try to do my best to explain to the Europeans that on the one hand, we're tough when it comes to the war on terror. On the other hand, we're providing more money than ever before in the world's history for HIV/AIDS on the continent of Africa. I'll say on the one hand, we're going to be tough when it comes to terrorist regimes who harbor weapons. On the other hand, we'll help feed the hungry. I declared Darfur to be a genocide, because I care deeply about those who have been afflicted by these renegade bands of people who are raping and murdering. And so I will do my best to explain our foreign policy. On the one hand, it's tough when it needs to be. On the other hand, it's compassionate.
President Bush speaking earlier this week in Vienna to members of the foreign press. Bill Curry, what do you make of the president's defense and in general, the broader discussion about the United States' image abroad?
I think it's the president's foreign policy over the last 6 years has brought us to the point at which our enemies don't fear us. North Korea is flaunting the idea of actually testing a missile that it describes it goes out of its way to describe as capable of reaching the west coast of the United States. Iran just trash talks us on the question of trying to reach some agreement about its nuclear program. Our enemies, because they've seen the limits of military power in this kind of cowboy unilateralism in Iraq, fear us less than they have in a long time. Our friends, as we saw in Vietnam and in Vienna, on the other hand, fear us a lot. They're looking at the pictures from Vienna. It wasn't just the people in the streets. It was the unsmiling fellow leaders of the other free nations of the world who just don't quite know what to do about a foreign policy this obtuse and a leader apparently incapable of reexamining his own conduct. And so that's where you don't want to be. If you really want to fight terrorism, it's a cooperative effort. And we really need to explain to the American people that, in fact, our security lies first and foremost in the rule of law, and that any meaningful anti a terrorism campaign is an anti-corruption campaign. It's a campaign that involves the goodwill and the sustained cooperation of people who right now look at us quite askance.
Hmm.
We have to there's no such thing as strong and dumb.
John
McWhorter, you want to be strong, you got to be smart.
Yeah, John McWhorter, Bill Curry says our enemies don't fear us and our friends don't like us anymore. That sounds like we got it pretty backwards there. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything that he just said, I could have said. And it's even worse if you ask me, because I see where President Bush is coming from and trying to point to what's going on with Darfur and with AIDS. And he has to be commended for certain gestures on the behalf of those two issues. But gestures only. It's hard to point to what's going on in Darfur and say that.
Wouldn't it, John?
Yeah. I mean, he says it's a genocide. That's nice. He gave it a name. But horrible things are still going on. And the agreement that they just reached was supported by a rebel leader who actually is not much better than the people who started the problem. And then as far as AIDS goes, this is also a government that supports abstinence and is reluctant to support contraceptives and things like that. So it's hideous. Even those things that he can point to are ones that I don't think that America really should be terribly proud of.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, it should be pointed out that the Europeans were happy with the president over the new departure on Iran, that they're dealing with the Europeans on that, and the president sounded reasonable on that. And this is a significant change. So I don't really think it's in some ways, people pointed out, he's thought of better by the leaders in Europe than he was just a couple of years ago when they were so intransigent on Iran. And let's just hope that that, too, the Iran change isn't just, as John said, a gesture, that they really do mean to do business, if you can do business, with Iran to get a stand down of their nuclear activities in exchange for various goodies that the West can give them. So I do think
Although Bush, in
that regard, had a, you know, that the Europeans are with him.
Wait, hold that thought, Bill, because we've got callers piling up who are dying to get into the middle of this conversation with you gentlemen. Michael is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Dubuque, excuse me, Michael. Welcome. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Good morning. We're talking about an overarching credibility problem, if you ask me, within and externally and internally within the United States. And earlier we were talking about the Democratic Party's inability to present an opposing viewpoint with any credibility. And I believe all that is linked back to the Democratic Party members who voted for the war in Iraq. And the only way we're going to get credible resistance is to purge the members of the Democratic Party, in fact, both parties, who voted for the war.
Yeah, but Michael, how is that going to happen, purge the members of the Democratic Party? What does that mean? What do the Democrats do for now? What do the Democrats do now in terms of policy?
Well, personally, I think we should look at everybody who voted for this war and begin a policy or begin a campaign to remove even the Democrats, even though I'm a Democrat, from party who voted for this war. We knew it was wrong from the start. It's still wrong. We should pull out, I think, get out of there, but it was wrong from the start. And how can people like John Kerry or Hillary Clinton, who voted for this war, ever hope to gain credibility with the American people, let alone the Democratic Party, when they put us in a position by voting for this war?
Well, Michael, let's put your point to our panelists of analysts here. Gentlemen, which one of you wants to respond to Michael's point? Go ahead, John.
It was never that cut and dried. I mean, obviously it's gone completely wrong, but I do believe that this could have, in an alternate universe, been done right. And I don't think it was unreasonable or immoral to suppose that 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I think, though, that in this universe, you know, where we all are now, The reasons not to do this to people who were thinking were clear from the absolute beginning. Some of those Democrats will tell you that they voted to authorize the president if he went back and found out things that he never actually went back and found out. In fact, it appears to have dissembled about to go ahead and protect the country. I thought that was a mistake. I don't think he'd earned that kind of trust. I don't think he'd made that kind of argument. But, you know, the Republicans have been, from my viewpoint, in the last 10 years, it's the Republicans who've been purging their party all the time. And I don't think in the end they're going to be glad that they've taken such a purist approach to it. Democrats haven't been as inclined toward purges. And on the whole, I think that's been to their benefit. You want to make a change? Get a Democratic House of Representatives. It's time to put Bush under some kind of political house arrest. Get some adult supervision of the executive branch of government this year. Don't waste your time punishing people who voted out of fear or who voted out of some kind of errant analysis. Make a change. Make a real change.
But Michael raises a good point, and that is that the Democrats have enabled this administration. I may have the wrong figure, but I believe 14 Democrats voted for the Bush tax cuts, including Dianne Feinstein, including Max Baucus, including, well, we could go on. They made that possible. And that, yet they turn around and complain about the deficit. Yet they can turn around and they complain about the giveaway to the rich. They voted for it. Democratic votes, again, Senator Feinstein, for the Medicare prescription drug bill that's a giveaway to the drug companies, Democratic votes made that possible. No Child Left Behind.
No Child Left Behind.
Which is a bureaucratic nightmare for the states. Ted Kennedy made that possible. You know, again and again,
Homeland Security.
Party has not played the role of an opposition party.
There's no question. It's harder when you don't control either house. But there's no question. Democrats don't know the difference between policy and message. You know, first you have to figure out what it is you believe and then how to tell people about it. The whole country is so hungry for politicians with the courage of their convictions. First, get some convictions. The courage will come later.
Well,
the Democrats don't have that. The Democrats don't have that, and I recognize it. But you can take on all 14 of those people. 13 of them will win their primaries. Speaking from the most narrow and speaking from my ancient partisan leanings, if I were a Democrat, a grassroots person upset with the course of this country, I'd look at trying to get power in order to make the change.
They're in too many people's pockets to actually give the kinds of votes that we would expect of an opposition party, and that's a deep systemic issue.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right.
Great. Well, Michael, thanks for the call.
We should stop agreeing so much, John. It's kind of scaring.
Yeah, I know. This isn't what
this is all making my head spin. The amount of agreement.
Really,
here.
I don't know what to do.
And then we had Jack Beatty defending the Bush administration a moment ago in Vienna. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what's happened to
so
you
strange.
All today. Mary is calling.
Jack was wrong about that, by the way.
Okay. Mary is calling from Iowa City. Mary, welcome. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I'm calling about the Voting Rights Act.
Yes, right. Go ahead, please.
Always the government, various people in the government, or entities of the government, always threatening this act. But it was Malcolm X who said we're going to have the ballot or the bullet. And as far as I'm concerned, we're headed for one of those Chinese-style cultural revolution. Well, you know, cultural revolution where everybody gets out in the street. And what's going to bring us out of Iraq is a suspension of posse comitatus. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. It's when we're out here in the streets fighting because we're losing. The American people are losing our so-called freedom that we fought so hard for.
So you're worried that Congress is actually going to not renew the Voting Rights Act? I mean, that's what you're concerned about.
I really don't even care at this point because I'm just tired of being threatened about the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action. I'm tired. It's time to throw down.
Anthony?
Yes.
You know, I think that really, I think the main thing is
John
that there is no evidence that anybody who is in a position of power these days is thinking, we don't want black people to vote because they're less than human and because they are the N-word. Those people shouldn't have a vote. And I'm going to toss something out very quickly. It's the kind of thing that gets me called controversial for some reason. But if every now and then there is some sleazy Republican who decides that they want to suppress the Democratic vote, if you are that kind of sleazeball, what easier thing would there be than to go and try to suppress votes in black neighborhoods because we are the people who vote Democratic most consistently in this country in the last presidential election? Asians and Hispanics split more or less down the middle for Bush versus Kerry, whereas with us,
you know,
it was practically to a man.
Let me get in on this,
Jack Beatty,
Anthony. I got a kick out of the Congressman Lynn Westmoreland of Georgia saying, you know, we don't do anything wrong down here. The Georgia legislature, Republican-dominated, last year revived the poll tax as a federal judge ruled. They came out with a bill that would essentially have limited voting to people who had to pay to get a license to vote. They had to pay $20 to $35. They and Georgia has 159 counties, and they only allowed these things to be purchased in 56 different locations, which didn't include Atlanta, the largest African American population.
But
and
Jack,
this
it,
in the
it
face
wasn't...
of the and this in the face of a report from the Georgia Secretary of State that said that she couldn't find a single case of voting fraud. So what we saw there was an effort literally to revive the poll tax today. So I don't see how we can talk to
you know,
not talk
with,
about
not
the,
with
you know,
an aim of suppressing the African American vote.
Well, what
I
do you think
agree.
The aim of it, John?
But with the effect, and I can't look into you know, anybody's eyes, Allah, Bush and Putin, and read their soul. That's not my business. I do know what the effect of that policy would have been. I want to really take issue with the caller's idea that it's time to throw it down. For God's sakes, it's a democracy, and we believe in reason, we believe in the rule of law, and we believe we can solve these problems. But I also believe, and I never peddle conspiracy theories to the best of my ability, but I look at Ohio and I look at Florida, and I disagree, John. I do see what appears to be, and particularly in Florida where some of the facts are in,
we agree again.
Conscious policies to exclude mm-hmm. African Americans because people
Definitely.
Think they're going to vote Democratic.
Because
so
they're going to vote Democratic.
As long as that's going on, that – yeah, but so –
But that's not
yeah,
what
again,
the
I'm not looking
Voting Rights Act
soul,
is about.
But it's a racist – no, but it was actually because that's the very reason they were excluded to begin with because they'd be voting wrong. If they were all going to go along and vote the way that the people who ran everything were, they probably wouldn't have been any problem.
Gentlemen,
but
I gotta,
those were
that
people
is,
who were
that,
trying
that,
to preserve –
That is why those laws have always –
Preserve Jim
not
Crow.
Not all hatred. Yeah, okay. That's yeah. right.
Gentlemen, let's leave the voting. Let's leave. Let's
preserve
let's,
the power. The powers that be.
Let's
was,
leave the discussion on voting
reason.
Rights just for
sure.
now because I want to move on
Different
to one
alignments today.
I'm sorry, John McWhorter. I want to move on to one more issue. Give you all a brief chance to talk about stories that perhaps are under the radar screen. Let me start briefly with you, Bill Curry. I know you've been following an interesting Senate race there, in Connecticut. That pits the incumbent Democrat, Joe Lieberman, very hawkish supporter of the war, against a Greenwich businessman named Ned Lamont. What's up with that race? Why is it significant? Why is it of interest?
Well, it's an ever-tightening race. The tactical question everybody's looking here is whether or not Lieberman's actually about to take out petitions. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if Lieberman ran on a as an independent. And just to reprise a point we've made here, that if in fact he's chased out of the party in a state where we have a chance to pick up two, possibly even three House seats, the effect in the general election, in fact, maybe not quite what Democrats anticipated. Ned Lamont turns out to be a very bright candidate, a much quicker study than anyone would have thought. This is about the war. Oddly enough, these guys strike me, having talked to, known Joe for 20 years and talked a great deal to Lamont in the last few weeks. These guys aren't all that far apart. It reminds me of when Howard Dean ran for president. He met Joe Trippi and decided that there was a big opening in the left, and this previous centrist became a great tribune for progressivism. This debate in Connecticut so far hasn't been about alternative policies for getting us out or alternative policies for keeping us out of these kinds of situations in the future. It's been a simple referendum on whether it was right to get in. We need a clearer, sharper debate here for this race to have more meaning. If it is a primary, it's going to go right down to the wire. Someone will win by a couple of points. My guess is that Lieberman goes independent.
Interesting. But Jack Beatty, does it say something interesting about what we can expect in races across the country with incumbents having to deal with their record on the war?
I don't know. I don't see any other such challenge around. This does seem unique. Perhaps it's not, but you know I think it was given some point this week. Ned Lamont said he would have voted for the Kerry or with the 11 sub whatever it was, he would have voted for some kind of deadline to get out of the war. Lieberman voted against it, so there it is. There's a clear issue difference that Connecticut voters will have to look on. You know, if Joe Lieberman goes to be independent, this is going to be a real question for the Democratic Party. Do they then support Ned Lamont? Who's the official candidate, or do they play by Senate rules, which is, well, we're all gentlemen here, and we'll give money to the independent. That's going to be a moment of
We are all out of time. There's obviously much more to talk about. I want to thank all three of you for joining us. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, Senior Editor of the Atlantic Monthly, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Bill Curry, columnist for the Hartford Current, thank you so much for joining us. It was great having you.
I had a blast. Thank you, Anthony.
And John McWhorter, you too. Thanks so much. Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We appreciated your insights and your time. Thanks so much.
It was a privilege.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.